Now, if you'll take out your scripture sheet, this is the last unit of the Gospel of John. And as we have come to see, it is very well structured. It begins with three dialogues. It closes with three uses of the word written. In verses 18 and 19, we hear of the death and destiny of Peter. And that's parallel to verses 23 on the death and destiny of John. And at the center, Peter and John are brought together. My experience is when I map the text, I can follow the flow of the author's thought and be a much more faithful interpreter of the church's book. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" Peter said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to Peter, "Graze my lambs." Again, a second time, he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Shepherd my flock." He said to him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved that he said to him a third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Graze my flock." Jesus said to Peter, "Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you girded yourself and walked where you would. But when you were old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish to go." This he did to show by what death he was to glorify God. After this, Jesus said, "Follow me." Peter turned and saw following them the disciple whom Jesus loved, who had lain close to his breast at the supper, and said to him, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "What about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If it is my will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? Follow me." The saying spread abroad among the brethren that the disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say that he was not to die, but "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?" This is the disciple who is bearing witness to these things, who has written these things, and we know that his witness is true. There are also many other things which Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose the whole world could not contain all the books that would be written. This is the word of the Lord. It is historically probable that the bones of both the apostles Peter and Paul are where early Christian tradition placed them. St. Peter under the altar at St. Peter's in Rome, and St. Paul just outside the city at the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. Several years ago, the BBC ran a program on the disciples, and here is their summary of Peter's death. Tradition since the end of the first century always maintained that Peter was martyred in Rome. Written accounts of his being crucified upside down so as not to be compared with his master are detailed, but later. The strongest evidence lay unchecked for centuries right under the noses of the Vatican. The magnificent basilica that now stands in the center of Vatican City was built to replace an original structure built by Constantine, the first Christian emperor, early in the 4th century. Constantine's basilica was a remarkable engineering feat. His men moved 1 million tons of earth from the hill in order to create a platform for the structure. But just to the side was a flat plot just yards away. Constantine went to such lengths in ground removal because he believed that this flat spot was the very spot Peter had been buried on the side of the Vatican Hill. Then in 1939, routine alterations under the floor of St. Peter's Basilica unearthed an incredible archaeological find. Archaeologists discovered a whole street of Roman mausoleums, highly decorated, and family tombs of both pagans and Christians dating to the early centuries A.D. They asked for papal permission to dig towards the high altar, and there they found underground a simple, shallow grave and some bodies. It took years for the bones to be analyzed and anticipation grew, but the results were disappointing. The bones were a random collection from 3 people and several animals. Years earlier, one of the Vatican officials overseeing the dig, removed some bones from a niche above the grave for safekeeping after the team had gone home. Amazingly, no one gave them a second thought till one of the experts asked whether anything was ever found in that empty niche. The bones were then analyzed. Tests showed they were the remains of a man in his 60s or 70s and of a stocky build. Yet perhaps even more revealing was the fragment of graffiti-covered plaster discovered next to the bones. The words were incomplete but could read, "Petros emi," meaning Peter is within. It's also likely that we know the exact date of St. Peter's death, October the 13th, 64 A.D. Could these be the bones of Peter? I think it's historically highly probable. But what would they mean? That's disputed because in the 16th century, the Protestants gave up the trade and veneration of relics. But since I have discovered this week that there are two verified locks of John Wesley's hair at the Methodist Museum in Lake Junaluska, no doubt to his great embarrassment, it shows that the Methodists have not even given up on the medieval practice of caring for relics. You see, in a universal sense that transcends cultures, it's one of the ways of staying in touch, and I mean literally, with our founders. People soon become long ago and far away, but to have something of them or something they used or touched is a bridge of sorts. The craze for sports memorabilia in America has much the same impulse. People pay money, real money, to have something of a Hall of Famer. A quick internet search this week revealed that Mickey Mantle's original baseball bat that he used with the Yankees is going on auction soon. They expect it to bring $200,000, not because the wood is valuable, but because of him who swung that bat to such effect. Now, the interest in Christian artifacts continues in our day, as evident in this year's TV specials around Easter about the bones of John the Baptist and the possible wood of the true cross brought back to Europe by Constantine's mother Helena after a fact-finding trip to the Holy Land. And sure, there are lots of fake relics, but the evidence is there are some that are true and may be accounted so by first-class historians and archaeologists. And I have an interest here, not because of any magical or power associations with the cross of Christ as a physical object, but because they are historical. And they remind us that the Christian faith is a historical faith. It's not about myth or legend or fairy tales. It's about things that happened. It's about people like Paul who wrote letters and whose bones are in Rome, and Peter who wrote letters and was probably behind the Gospel of Mark, whose bones are likely under that altar. We are a historical faith. The resurrection is something that happened to Jesus Christ. You see, Paul left bones behind, and Peter left bones behind, and John the Baptist left bones behind, and I will leave bones behind, and you will leave bones behind. But Jesus left no bones behind. The tomb was empty. The body was transformed, taken up into a new resurrection body. And the heritage that Jesus left is not bones in a grave, but a living Lord who rules over His people. I love this next story. What do you do with a risen Jesus who grills breakfast for his tired buddies? Here are Peter and the guys who are still walking in the valley of the shadow of death of humans, and Jesus steps out of his invisibility into their presence. Bearing the marks of crucifixion is still him, but a body with marvelous news. What do you do with the risen Lord who gets involved with gathering charcoal and heating bread and bringing fish? You see, God loves the creation. God's not going to do away with the creation. If God resurrected the body of Jesus, if that broken, bloody, dead corpse was not tossed aside, but drawn up into the resurrection body, it can happen to the whole of creation. And that's what Jesus means. He's a window into a whole new world. This whole world, all its physicality, is going to be healed and restored. You see, God's in the recycling business. I don't know about y'all, but I love watching the Velocity Channel late at night. Because, see, I got some NASCAR roots. My mother's uncle built Rockingham Motor Speedway. He built half of Charlotte Motor. He's one of the founders of NASCAR. Now, my mother didn't tell me that until I was 30 years. Oh, she knew I drove too fast anyway. She did not want to encourage me. He fed him. He said, "Peter, let's go take a walk." Now, Peter thought he was a brave man. He'd been proved to be a coward. You know, my father used to say, "Philip Carlyle, let's go take a walk." I knew I was in trouble. And he said, "Simon, son of John," he didn't call him Peter, he called him by his daddy's name. And they go for a walk, and Jesus does not correct Peter in front of the other six. He does not humiliate him. He does not rub his nose in his cowardly and lying. Jesus takes him aside, and they go for a stroll on the same beach where Jesus called him 3 years earlier. And the charcoal fire recalls the charcoal fire in the high priest's courtyard. "Peter, do you love me more than these other guys love me?" "You used to think you did. You thought you were going to die for me and you were the brave guy. Lord, you know I love you." And Jesus recommissioned him, then "take care of my people." "Simon, do you love me more than these?" "Lord, you know I love you." He said, well, "shepherd my sheep." It wasn't until the third time that Peter knew what Jesus was doing, because here it says he was grieved. Jesus tapped into all Simon's failure, that three times he had denied his Lord. The third time, Jesus looked at him. "Simon, do you love me?" "Lord, you know everything there is to know about me. You know that I'm not the man I thought I was. You know that I'm a coward. You know that I'm a failure. You know that I don't deserve to be in your presence. But I swam towards you out of the boat because I just got to be near you. You know everything. You know I love you. Shepherd my sheep." One by one, Jesus has him make a confession of love. Not to make up for, but to give him a chance to reaffirm that for every betrayal, there was forgiveness. How tender and kind is Jesus that he recycles people. He doesn't throw anyone away. It was his brokenness. It was his failure. It was his willingness to be restored by love that fitted Peter to be the shepherd of God's flock. To teach them. To tell them the stories of Jesus, to deal tenderly with the young, to correct the others, to hold the church together, to care for them. Now, some people say, "Fill in Main Street, your church," and that it makes me nervous because you're not my flock. I serve you a couple years as an under-shepherd, but Jesus said, "My sheep, my people, my flock." They're not Peter's. He doesn't own them. Sometimes the Lord has to say to pastors, "Take your hands off my people." We are to work, we are to serve, we are to teach the faith, we are the model, we are to care for God's people. But they do not belong to us, and we do not fleece them. "Peter, when you were young, you kind of ran your own life. And when you're old, you'd be like an old man stretching out his arms for help." And that put Peter right in the middle. He was no longer young. He wasn't yet feeble. Peter was kind of in the middle of his life, and Jesus is reinventing him with a new vocation. And the new vocation is the same as the old. It is to be a follower of Jesus, to love Him so that you can love and serve and lead His people. 30 years later, Nero would have Peter stretched out on a cross. And historical legend is that Peter was crucified upside down. We know that Roman soldiers sometimes crucified so many people, they did it in a variety of positions just to break the monotony. And the church says Peter did it because he didn't want to be compared with his Lord. For 30 years, Peter wandered the Mediterranean, shepherding God's people as a missionary pastor. And then after Rome burned and the Christians caught it, Peter was crucified upside down. But you know, even after his restoration, Peter had a problem. And that's so encouraging to me. Peter was never perfect, but he was made whole. So when Jesus and he finished their little walk, Peter turns around and sees John following. John never betrayed Jesus. John was at the cross. John's got to take care of Jesus' mama. John always loved Jesus. He never failed. He's everything Peter's not. And Peter turns around and says, "That guy, what's going to happen to him? You tell me, I'm going to die on a cross. What's happening to this guy you think is so special?" Fearing what Jesus said. In Greek, it means none of your business. But he said, "If I choose that he remain until I return, what business is that of yours? You have enough trouble following me. You leave him to me." I like that because it reminds me that I have enough trouble following him. I shouldn't be worried about what some other pastor in some other church is doing. Jesus did not assign me their supervision. He assigned me to be a shepherd and to be a teacher and to tend the flock and to make sure that I'm following him in all my brokenness and all my humanity. Even after Peter was restored, Jesus still had to rebuke him. I find that greatly encouraging. So when the Lord rebukes me for some meddling attitude in somebody else's ministry, I can say, I'm in the company of St. Peter. Now it's interesting where this story ends. It ends with the memory that there was an eyewitness of the life of Jesus who was at the foundation of the community that gave us the Gospel of John. He was the beloved disciple. It may have been John the Apostle, but it's still a theological mystery. But he was a witness of extraordinary insight and discernment. And he did not die in the 60s when Peter and Paul died. He apparently lived well into the mid-90s of the first century as a very old man, most likely in Ephesus. Peter was a martyr. John was a witness that went all the way to the end of the first century. And Polycarp, that great second century bishop who was martyred, was trained by John the Apostle. And the purpose of that is so the living witness of Jesus, of those who knew him in the flesh, could continue well into the second century and guarantee this gospel. And the community said, we know that his witness is true. And we know that were he to write 100 gospels, the world is not big enough to carry and cover the beauty and truth of Jesus Christ, who is still in the business of calling people to be his followers. I tell people, I've been following him this summer for 43 years. I remember kneeling in that little Episcopal church in Trall about 11 o'clock at night on July the 2nd, 1972, with a shattered life and a broken heart. And I remember him saying, "Hey, Threlkill." "Yes, sir." "Yeah, you. You. Follow me." And I've been trying to keep up with him ever since. And whenever I fall or stray, he picks me up. He dusts me off. He works it through. And the question is not, am I perfect, but do you love me? And will you take care of my people? Follow me. And that is the adventure of the Christian life. That we follow a living Lord. If I can go through all my books and find the hymnal. Folks, I want to sing to you sometimes, not because I got a great voice, but because I know the one I'm singing about. And so I want to sing to you the first stanza as an invitation. Then I want you to stand and join me on stanzas 2 and stanza 5. Josh?
Jesus calls us o'er the tumult of our lives, while restless seen, day by day His sweet voice soundeth, saying, Christian, follow me.
Please stand.
Thank you.